It is the morning show. I'm Kate Archer Kent. Americans feel widely pessimistic about how democracy is working or how well the political system in our country represents people's interests. That's polling over the summer by the Associated Press, NORC Center for Public Affairs Research. We have a roundtable discussion here on American democracy, and you can take part. Call in with a question or comments at 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. Charlie Sykes is a founder and editor at large of The Bulwark, a conservative journal that offers analysis and reporting in defense of America's liberal democracy. Charlie, welcome back to the Ideas Network.
Good to be here.
Good morning. David Graham here as well, staff writer at The Atlantic, covering politics and national affairs. David, welcome back.
My pleasure.
David, starting with you, in recent years, political commentators and academics, they've been sounding the alarm that our democracy is failing. And you're a veteran political reporter. How significant is the peril facing our country?
You know, it's interesting if you look at what experts say versus what people say. Experts have been warning for some time about these major problems, about polarization, about calcification, about the ways the system has just sort of become unworkable. And it's taken the American public, I think, a little bit of time to catch up to that. But increasingly, you see in polls, people are really worried. You have majorities of voters in both parties often saying that they just don't feel like the system works. And I think if we look around there, you know, we can see why people feel that. It makes a lot of sense.
Charlie, what do you see as the biggest threat facing our country and our political system?
Well, I think, first of all, you know, when we talk about, you know, democracy, what I think we really mean is liberal constitutional democracy, that whole system of the rule of law and checks and balances. And what we're seeing is that it's being massively stress tested at every single level of government here. The attack on the rule of law, the inability of some of the institutions to stand up against some of the demagoguery. And of course, you made reference to what's happening here in Wisconsin, which is, I have to tell you, breathtaking, even by the standards of Wisconsin partisanship, where you quite literally have Republicans poised to use their gerrymandered supermajority to wipe out the results of an election, to simply erase the vote of more than a million Wisconsinites who voted for a progressive Supreme Court justice. That I think, takes us into a whole new territory where we're not just talking about election denialism. We're talking about active election nullification. And if that's not a threat to the democratic process, I don't know what would be.
When you look at that, David, Wisconsin Republicans perhaps seeking to impeach the liberal Justice Janet Protasiewicz, how do you see in the broader context of American democracy and the challenges it faces?
I think it's a great example of a lot of things that are going on. You know, one thing we see is increased polarization even at the state level. For a long time, you know, even after the national political scene was so tight, you saw states working on a little bit more pragmatic level because there are things that have to get done and people are close to the ground. But now we see that, you know, state legislators and sometimes governors are willing to play this kind of hardball, the sort of winner-take-all politics that we see at the national level. We've also seen courts, which used to be a little bit insulated from the political process, and, you know, where people were at least willing to pay lip service to the idea that courts should be independent, increasingly a focus of partisan warfare. And so you see that even more in state courts. So, you know, what you're seeing in Wisconsin, I think, is maybe the most dramatic example. But we saw a threat by Republicans to impeach a Republican state Supreme Court Chief Justice in Ohio. We've seen court packing in Arizona and Georgia. There's a law in Kentucky that allows Republican legislators to basically bypass a single judge who they don't like, who's been ruling against them in the Capitol area. So this sort of assault on state courts, I think, is a trend nationwide, and that is part of a general feeling that politics can get into anywhere. There is no part, no institution, and no part of the government that should be beyond the sort of electoral process, and anything is really fair game.
David Graham covers politics and national affairs for The Atlantic. We have Charlie Sykes, a former conservative talk show host from Wisconsin, editor-at-large of The Bulwark, as we take stock on the health of America's democracy and what you think. You can join the conversation with your questions, your insights, 800-642-1234. Email ideas at WPR.org. And let's bring in Amel Ahmed, an associate professor of political science at University of Massachusetts Amherst. Amel, welcome to the Ideas Network.
Thank you. Great to be here.
Is the United States democracy in peril right now?
So I think I take a little bit of a different take from some of my colleagues and other scholars of democracy. I would say first that I do think it is in peril. Where I differ is how extraordinary I think this is, or how unusual I think it is. And I think, you know, if we are placing the present moment in a historical context and in a comparative context, we could see that this kind of these fights over democracy historically have been very much a part of our democracy. Mm-hmm. And we could consider them part of how democratic politics is played out. Now, a lot of people might agree with that historically and think, well, then we got to, you know, the civil rights era and these things were resolved. And I would say that, you know, this era that we look to is kind of the old golden age of democratic consolidation and stability and party politics. That was actually the exception. And there are many things about it that were unusual and produced this kind of consensus over democracy that in many ways was forced or artificial and something that we benefited from. But I do think right now it's important to keep in mind that these fights that we're facing are very serious and they are dangerous. And all of these things are true, but it does matter how we put it in perspective. And I think it's important to understand that these fights are part of democratic politics and we have tools, we have resources, and we have, comparatively speaking, a strong democracy with strong institutions that are being strained right now. But democratic contention and these fights that we're seeing, they're a part of the thing that we should be engaging in as democratic citizens.
Given our country has weathered, you know, the Civil War, the Great Depression, World War II, Amel, is there reason to believe we can pull through this, the loss of faith in American democracy?
I think there's absolutely a reason. I think there are serious dangers. It's already been mentioned. Polarization is probably the biggest danger that we're facing, not just because we are divided. Historically, there are plenty of periods where we've been divided, but we're seeing a kind of effective polarization where we see what we call it effective polarization, meaning one side sees the other as an enemy, not just a competitor. So it's not just about a political competition, that there are a lot of, on both sides, there is a vilification of the other. The other thing that I think is super dangerous is about polarization is we no longer have a shared meaning of democracy. Each side is invoking different democratic principles, and that is really destabilizing. And I say with all of that, absolutely, we have resources and we have the capacity to overcome this. And we're actually in much better shape than we were at other points where democracy was seriously challenged. There are new challenges today, for sure. And, you know, we've mentioned election denial and the challenges to election. That is destabilizing. When losers don't accept losses in a democracy, that's something that is of serious concern. But even there, we still see we have mechanisms. We have election administrators, we have courts, and so far, those challenges have gone through the proper protocols, and we have ways to respond to that, which is why I keep saying our institutions are still strong. Mm. And when we look at other democracies that are suffering serious setbacks, that's not just a situation where elections are challenged. That's a situation where public figures come out and say, we shouldn't have elections. This is not the way. But we haven't had anything like that. We still believe in elections.
Let's hear from Marcus in Milwaukee with thoughts. Marcus, hi.
Good morning. So I don't really think it matters which party it is that starts it or does it, because eventually they both do it. But what I see is one of the major problems is the one-upmanship that goes back and forth between each side. Well, you took this and did this, so we're going to take and block this over here. It's costing the country so much money, and it's taking us down a path which I believe puts us one step closer to going from a democratic republic to something more like a socialist country, or where there's a dictatorship. As Ben Franklin said, We have a democracy if you can keep it.
Marcus, thank you. Charlie, your thoughts there on the one-upmanship.
Well, that's actually a very interesting point, because I do think that you have this sort of, you know, spiral of escalation that people ought to be very concerned about. And I guess I am somewhat more alarmed than your other guests about all of this, because, yes, we have seen these challenges before. But I think there's also a, you know, and so one model we could look at, this is a pendulum swinging back and forth. But another model is the ratchet, is that every time we lose something, every time we destroy a norm, every time we move toward authoritarianism or begin to question whether or not we really want to be a democracy, it's hard to go back. And I think one of the things we've learned is that, you know, despite American exceptionalism, we are not exceptionally immune to the kinds of forces that have destroyed democracies in other countries. And I think we live in a completely new information era that is very, very different than we faced in previous crises, that will make it much more difficult, I think, for us to snap back. And I do think that you are seeing a much more coherent authoritarian threat than we have faced in, at least in my lifetime. And it is backed by an information ecosystem that makes the normal democratic give and take much more difficult. So I am alarmed about this.
Political commentator and editor at large of The Bulwark, Charlie Sykes. David Graham is here, staff writer at The Atlantic, and Amel Ahmed, political scientist at University of Massachusetts Amherst, as we examine the state of democracy, how it can be improved in America. Call in with your insights, your take, ask a question, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We probe the question, are Wisconsinites losing faith in democracy, as we examine fundamentals of our political system and significant threats. Call in with a question, share your perspective, email ideas at WPR.org. We have Wisconsin-based national political commentator and founder of The Bulwark, Charlie Sykes, is here, and UMass Amherst Associate Professor of Political Science, Amel Ahmed, as well as The Atlantic staff writer, David Graham, covering national politics. David, you write that having former President Donald Trump facing criminal charges during the election campaign next year will be a mess. What do you foresee happening?
I mean, what we see already is Trump treating the trial more as a political potential asset than as a trial. You know, the sorts of messaging he's doing around it, the way he's choreographing his appearances in court, the way he's using it as a fundraising boon, and the sorts of motions he's filing seem less aimed at actually mounting a successful defense and more aimed at ginning up political outrage around that. And I think that pushes us towards politicization of the courts and gives the impression that courts are just, you know, a tool of political persecution. And I think the courts are also, you know, in a little bit of a supine position. They're designed to not take into account the election calendar. They're designed to stay outside of politics. And so they're fighting a little bit of an asymmetric war, where they don't have a whole lot of ways to ratchet down that politicization, but Trump is happy to use it for his own political ends.
Charlie, President Gerald Ford, going back in history, pardoned Richard Nixon, arguing it would help the nation heal, move on from Watergate. How will prosecuting former President Trump affect our democracy?
Well, first of all, I agree with everything David just said there. The prosecution of Donald Trump is, of course, going to be, you know, very politically messy. It's going to be complicated, but it's necessary to reaffirm that in our constitutional republic, nobody is above the law, that there are, in fact, consequences, that these checks and balances that we have do, in fact, work. The failure to prosecute Donald Trump would essentially say that a president cannot be charged while he's in office, and then an ex-president cannot be charged, you know, after he leaves office, which essentially means that the president is lawless. Now, I will confess that at the time I was relieved that that Gerald Ford had pardoned Richard Nixon, that it had really ended our great national nightmare. In retrospect, however, I think that it set a dangerous precedent because it established this idea that somehow the presidency had this unique status that we did not dare hold them accountable for the crimes they committed. But if a president of the United States, a sitting president of the United States, can actually try to overturn a legitimate election and impede the peaceful transfer of power, and we do not hold him accountable under the Constitution, then we've lost something pretty fundamental.
Let's bring on a call. Alan with us from Wisconsin Dells. Alan, what are your thoughts here? We hear your radio in the background. Yes, go ahead.
Okay, I just turned it down. I'm a former circuit court judge in Columbia County, which is in Portage, Wisconsin, and I now serve as a reserve judge. And the only comment I wanted to make was that the peril of the democratic system and the peaceful transfer of power, in my estimation, is being upheld by actual people who are jurors on people charged, sitting on juries, the people that had been charged with trying to overturn the election. There's a consequence for that. We had 22-year sentence given to the Proud Boys head. We've had upwards of 20 years and several other cases on these conspiracy trials. And people have to remember, these are 12 jurors, and I can tell you, sitting on many jury trials, jurors take their responsibility extremely seriously. So I think that the judiciary, and then, of course, the judges handing out sentences, which are appropriate, all brings back at least some semblance of rule of law. And I think that in the end we're going to be okay, but it's going to be a struggle if all those people end up getting pardoned sometime in the future. Thank you.
Thank you, Ellen. Appreciate the call. Amel, looking back at the political violence at the Capitol on January 6th was something the country hasn't seen in decades, and since the Vietnam War, civil rights era. How does political violence affect the governments and democracy of countries? And what is the role of courts and, the people who serve on juries?
So I think in my mind, political violence is probably the biggest threat you can see within a democracy. And January 6th is definitely an example of that. An attempt to overturn an election, all of that spells, danger and trouble for democracy. Essentially, the political violence puts an end to the normal mechanisms, to what we would fight, how we would conduct our competition and our fights. And it becomes a question of who's stronger militarily and in terms of their might. So this is the thing that really puts democracies in danger across the globe. And so to see even an instance of that in the U.S., again, it's not as if U.S. history is without political violence. There has been ample evidence of that. But on each occasion, it's going to put democracy in danger. And now looking at the courts as the mechanism of upholding the rule of law, I think that's very important. I think we can't just look to the courts, but so far, as the caller said, the courts have really been standing up and upholding the rule of law in a way that other institutions have not been able to. And I think that's important. I do think we should not count on that entirely. It's just a matter of time before the courts become politicized. And what we see in other democracies is, unless you can arrest the movement of these democratic challenges, every institution is going to become implicated eventually. And you'll see efforts to put more compliant judges on the courts eventually.
Mm. David, do you anticipate that there could be more violence, President Trump, front runner for the Republican nomination for president next year?
I do. And I want to be careful about this, because there have been so many times where people like me have wrung our hands and warned that there'll be violence. I think of President Trump's arraignment in Florida, where there was really nothing, but the conditions are there. We see We've already seen violence break out. And, you know, we saw violence on a small level, even during the 2016 campaign, where you had people at Trump rallies with Trump's encouragement punching protesters. By and large, people in both parties say that they are more willing to accept the idea of political violence against the other side. This is that effective polarization that Amel was talking about. And, you know, what really seems to make a difference in those cases is whether or not you have leaders who are willing to encourage it in either party. And obviously we have Republican leaders, and particularly Trump, who are willing to encourage it.
Atlantic staff writer David Graham there. We have perspectives from political scientist Amel Ahmed, former conservative talk show host in Milwaukee. Charlie Sykes is here. You can be part of the conversation, 800-642-1234. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. The ailing health of U.S. democracy is something Americans find common ground on. A recent USA Today Suffolk University poll says Democrats and Republicans are worried about the future of American democracy. We talk about this with Wisconsin-based national political commentator and editor-at-large of The Bulwark. Charlie Sykes is here, along with UMass Amherst political scientist Amel Ahmed and David Graham, staff writer at The Atlantic. Let's bring in perspective from Martha in Menominee. Martha, hi. What's on your mind?
You know, I think I agree with Charlie. I'm a little more worried than your female guest. She mentioned that we had protocols in place to keep things on an even keel, election administration and the courts. Well, if you listen to the news just now in the last blurb, the Wisconsin Republicans have decided to not reinstate Megan Wolf. And the courts, well, Janet got in due to the turnout of the young people in Wisconsin. Thank you, young people. But now they're trying to mess with that. So in a state that does not have initiative or referendum like Michigan, Michigan seems to have taken care of this problem. What does a Democratic-leaning, Republican-leaning person do in a state that is so gerrymandered that we're just going in circles? Help, somebody advise.
Charlie, you first. Go ahead with those comments.
Well, this is part of the problem, because there is no easy answer for this. I don't know that there is going to be a successful court challenge to the removal of the justice. And without the Supreme Court taking action, these lines are going to continue. And basically, the problem with Wisconsin is that even though Republicans get about 53% of the vote statewide in legislative races, they have about 65% of the vote in the state assembly. They have super majorities. And look, they feel deeply entitled to keep that gerrymandered majority. For them, this is an existential issue. And the only thing the Democrats can do is try to continue to win elections. But here's the rub. What happens when you win an election? A high turnout, very expensive election by 11 points with more than a million votes in April, and the Republican legislature just says, "Nah, we're gonna undo it. We're going to wipe that election away." This is where I think you get a great deal of disillusionment. I think you're going to have even more polarization, and I say that in a state that's already deeply polarized. But I expect there's going to be a lot of disillusionment about the process, if in fact Republicans pull the trigger on this.
Amel, what are your thoughts there as what is unfolding in Wisconsin, and as you look elsewhere in the country, what are the mechanisms that could help put checks and balances here?
So I think I would first say that my view of this isn't that there isn't danger. There is very serious danger, and the challenges to the court system and to election administration are really high among those. I think my effort to put this in historical perspective isn't to say that this is business as usual or normal politics. It's especially the image of a pendulum would suggest that this is going to auto-correct. that the pendulum swings this way and then it swings back that way. This is not going to autocorrect unless we address it and fight it. But I think the important thing here is to fight this not just ideologically, but to fight it politically. And with each of these moves, with gerrymandering, with the checks, with the challenges to election administration, with the efforts to take over leadership of election administration, which we saw abundantly in 2022, each of these is a political move. It's one we're unaccustomed to. So it's, you know, it's taking us by surprise. And we want to point to this being a violation of democratic norms. But we are in a moment where we do not agree on the democratic norms. We don't have a common definition of democracy or what are the most important values of democracy, which means that we need to maneuver in a political manner. So we can challenge these outcomes the same way our opponents challenge them, without vilifying them, without casting them as autocrats. We can say, well, this is the next move. We can see they have told us what they're going to do. They have told us they're going to challenge the courts. They have told us they are going to challenge these offices of election administrators. So we need to respond accordingly. This is not the same politics that we had a decade ago or two decades ago, but we do have tools to respond.
Let's bring in Steve in Oshkosh. Steve, hi, go ahead.
Hi. I have read that the voting procedure that we use, where we have a plurality winner or a simple majority winner, can actually drive candidates apart, polarize. And there's a theoretical solution where you basically, instead of electing by plurality or simple majority, you elect by highest average ranking. You rank the candidates, and the candidate with the highest average rank is the winner. If you do it that way, polarization becomes a losing strategy.
Steve, thanks for the call. David Graham at The Atlantic, ranked choice voting, your insights there.
Yeah, I mean, I think ranked choice voting is promising in some situations, and it seems to produce more centrist candidates. We've seen this in a place like Alaska in the most recent election, where a Democrat won unexpectedly, partly because of ranked choice voting. And there have been some really heartening experiments with that in various places. You know, I think where it gets into trouble is it hits the same political realities. So as ranked choice voting has spread in a few places, you see, first of all, people attacking it, particularly Republicans, you know, arguing that it is another kind of fraud. So you've seen this sort of language about it that you've seen about other parts of the election system. And you have to get it passed in places where there's already extreme polarization, and those are the hardest measures. You know, legislators don't want to change a system that is benefiting them, slanted to generate to help them. And so it's hard to put that into place unless you have a way for the people to push a referendum and win that. So I think we're seeing some growth of it, but I don't know what the sort of limits on how large it might be are.
Charlie, what reforms would benefit democracy in America and here in Wisconsin?
Well, first of all, I do think that ranked choice voting is something that ought to be considered, even though it is a little bit wonky. I think that in terms of reforms, one of the things we have to do is sort of go back to first principles, including what used to be the consensus about the independence of the judiciary. I think that in many ways, there's not a magic bullet. If the American people in their political culture lose faith in democracy, or if they adopt attitudes that are fundamentally anti-democratic, then I'm not sure that there's any system that's going to be able to solve this. I mean, clearly, we need fairer maps. We need to actually have more competitive maps. One of the things that we've lost in our political culture is the willingness and ability to persuade. So it is all appealing to the base and to the basis instincts of the base in terms of our politics. And these things are not easily fixed, particularly, you know, in a world where we have two separate realities, where we don't have shared understandings of democracy. We don't have shared understandings of what it means to be an American. So this is a very, very complicated problem. What needs to be done in the near term, though, obviously, is to resist these anti-democratic initiatives, like what's happening in Wisconsin, to note how serious the ongoing attack on the judicial system is politically. I mean, you know, David made reference to the fact that what's happening in Wisconsin is happening around the country. And I would point out how it has become, you know, very much a live issue in Congress and in the presidential race to use congressional power to obstruct justice, to defund the Department of Justice, to defund prosecutors, to attack the jury system, to attack and vilify judges. If that is not resisted, if those institutions do not survive this onslaught, things are going to get much worse.
As we take stock of the health of America's democracy, we have Charlie Sykes there, editor-at-large of The Bulwark. David Graham covers politics for The Atlantic. Amel Ahmed is a political scientist at University of Massachusetts Amherst. You can join in the conversation at 800-642-1234. Amel, the Brennan Center for Justice at New York University says multiracial democracy in America is under siege, with attempts to limit who can vote and attempts to discredit the 2020 election with lies. How much damage is being done to democracy through attacks on voting?
I think this has been historically a challenge for U.S. democracy. And if we look at U.S. democracy in comparison to even other established democracies across the globe, this issue of inclusion has been an area where we've never reached full democratic consolidation, meaning we have never been at a point in our history where it's fully secure and fully confident. You know, for a moment during the civil rights era, it felt like we'd passed a threshold, and now, but it's never felt totally stable. And so what we're seeing now is a part of that, but it's also evolved because we are able to target voters much more. Now, the one thing I will say is that this back and forth, this kind of competition over the right to vote, also is, we have tools for that. And we know that in areas where the right to vote is attacked and where mechanisms are put in place to block ballot access and all these different maneuvers, we've actually seen voter participation increase, because people mobilize and they're aware of these tactics, and we need to continue doing that. And I think we need to be even more aggressive with the right to vote, which we all know is not guaranteed to us in the US Constitution. And we need to make greater demands of that and make greater demands. Potentially, I've seen proposals for a constitutional amendment to secure the right to vote. I think that would be an excellent move. Of course, a constitutional amendment is very hard to secure, but there are other ways we can be more aggressive in demanding the right to vote and also the supports that are necessary to make this right meaningful.
What are those supports necessary to make these rights meaningful? Give an example there.
So I tend to think of this as similar to the battle for entitlements, because we know that economic rights are also not guaranteed in the Constitution. And this is the idea of economic rights is something that was cultivated by social movements who said, you know, these we cannot provide for our own welfare on our own. The state has an obligation to help us with this. And I think we can see an analogy with the right to vote, because the right is there, but we know that so much of the ability to exercise that vote is the ability to get information, is the right to be mobilized. We rely on parties to mobilize voters, to tell them when to vote, to tell them how to vote, to provide all of this information that voters need, because most voters aren't paying that close attention. And so I think we can make more demands that in order for us to actually exercise this right effectively, we need support. We need support in terms of time off, for example. Time off to vote would be a huge move in order to secure the right to vote. We need information from third parties, because we know parties mobilize strategically, and there are certain constituencies that will never hear from anyone at the time of an election because they're not competitive. So these things all need to be thought through, I think, with a view to providing as much of the population as possible the supports and resources needed for them to engage actively in the exercise of this right.
Political scientist at University of Massachusetts Amherst, Amel Ahmed there. We have Wisconsin-based political commentator, founder of The Bulwark, Charlie Sykes, along with The Atlantic staff writer David Graham, as we examine the future of our democracy. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show on the Ideas Network. It is The Morning Show. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. We examine strategies to support American democracy as some scholars caution of a dangerous inflection point. Politics Roundtable is here. Political scientist Amel Ahmed, The Atlantic's David Graham, and Wisconsin-based national political commentator Charlie Sykes. And you can join in with your email to ideas@wpr.org. Charlie, over the past several years, you've become a fierce critic of the Republican Party, which you used to support. Is there anything about the party that gives you hope that it will change course?
Well, unfortunately, not in the short term. In fact, if anything, it appears to be escalating. I mean, the fact that you have the vast majority of Republicans, Republican primary voters, who are saying that they will support Donald Trump for another term, despite the fact that he's been indicted on 91 felony charges. I mean, that is not a good omen, is it? When asked whether they would support a convicted felon for president, six of the eight Republican candidates for president raised their hands. I mean, there are voices out there who are pushing back against this. I mean, I think they're a little late to the party. Mike Pence gave a speech last week where he talked about the unbridgeable differences between Trumpian populism and conservatism. But of course, he was there for 4 years making it happen. Chris Christie has been, I think, the most eloquent voice against the trends in the party. But then again, he played a central role in the rise of Donald Trump. So look, this country needs two sane political parties. We're never going to be a country that simply has one party. We're not going to be able to salvage a liberal constitutional democracy with the support of just the Democratic Party. But I think it's going to be a very, very long slog. And right now it's very, very much uphill.
David in Germantown. David, hi.
For taking, getting me on. Hey, I appreciate your female guest. Was it Imelda or Mel?
Amel Ahmed.
Mel, and her historical perspective, and it makes me think back to the election of 1824, and I think everybody, it would be good to spend a half an hour going back and looking at the corrupt bargain, the John Quincy Adams cut to win over Jackson, and the consequences of the blowback in 1828, and all of that. So anyway, I appreciated that, but that wasn't my comment. My comment is concerning the bureaucracy, the deep state, or whatever, and it's just completely lost its credibility, as is traditional media. And I think people they feel gaslighted, because the things that traditional conservatives, you know, my National Review and like your guest, Charlie Sykes, the things that they're saying defy what they're seeing. And so they see the hypocrisy. They see the persecution or the prosecution of Trump as just election interference. And they see the hypocrisy that went on with Hillary and so on and so forth through the years, back and forth. I mean, you could give a dozen examples. And so they just don't trust the information. That's not their fault. You know, that's not their fault. It's there. They're seeing it. It's right in front of them. And so they feel gaslighted. And then my last comment is this Oliver Anthony thing. You know, I'm not even a country western fan, but he immediately reminded me of Woody Guthrie in the 1930s. And I just think there's this underlying working middle class that the Democrats used to represent, that the Republicans are starting to represent, or trying to, in this populist Republican new Trumpian world, whatever. Somebody has got to represent these people. And again, just this protest, Oliver Anthony's song, Richmond North Away, just reminds me of Woody Guthrie. And so that's just some reflections and comments on my part.
David, thank you for those reflections. And turning now to David Graham, what comes up for you here?
I think it is true that there is real distrust in institutions like the media. I think some of that is earned, and I think some of it is not. You know, I think we see people being told that things are true, you know, whether that's in a lot of the conservative media or by their leaders, and they do believe those things. I think, you know, it's a responsibility of voters to sort out the truth from what's not the truth, and to see where there are similarities, but things are not equivalent. And I think we see that in the case of Trump and you know, prosecution of Trump. The question about populism, I think, is really interesting. You see Democrats really taking on messaging that I think is driven by and often aimed at sort of elites, well-educated people. And you see the Republican Party under Trump aiming more on this populist message. I think there's still a policy disconnect. Trump, you know, proposed a tax policy. If he were to be reelected president, I believe yesterday, it would be heavily redistributing to the wealthy. So, you know, on the level of policy, it's divided, but I think you definitely see that split in the messaging. And I think it's really consequential for where our politics are going.
Amel, how much will the next presidential election make or break American democracy?
I think not so much the outcome, but the conduct of the election is what's really at stake. And what, you know, the extent to which the election ends up polarizing people, or we are able to maintain some kind of center. And I think the caller brought up, some really important points that people are watching what's happening in disbelief. And that kind of contributes to a polarization, it ups the ante, and then one side is willing to go even farther. And so I'm gonna say that what I think is most needed here, something that you will not often hear from social scientists, but I think what is most needed is a moment of political empathy. And what I mean by that is conducting the election with the understanding that the other side sees things fundamentally differently. Mm-hmm. We are operating in a different moral universe, and we are operating in a different political universe. That doesn't mean we stop fighting for the version of democracy that we want and need. But it does mean something different for how we conduct ourselves in this competition, understanding that it's a competition. We want different outcomes, and that's what this election is meant to manage.
It sounds like you're saying that we have to learn how to humanize each other and perhaps build a more understanding or kind of inclusive citizenship in our country.
I think, you know, absolutely, even just as a thought exercise, the kind of rhetoric I hear is really troubling, because I don't believe that half of this country has suddenly adopted autocratic characteristics or that they don't want democracy. Hmm. So if we suspend disbelief and try to imagine what is it that they're after, if they're acting in this way, and we put aside this idea that they are aspiring autocrats, what is it that they aspire for? What is it that they care about and value? And we will probably come to the conclusion that it's very different from what we care about and value, but that still puts us in a different kind of competition with them. Mm.
Thank you all for joining us. Amel Ahmed there, Associate Professor of Political Science at the University of Massachusetts Amherst. Charlie Sykes, Editor-at-Large of The Bulwark, a former Wisconsin conservative talk show host. David Graham, covering politics and national affairs for The Atlantic. I'm Kate Archer-Kent. You're listening to The Morning Show here on the Ideas Network.